Sarah Hicks decided that she hasn't been on enough podcasts and she wanted to be on one more. So thank you, Sarah, for choosing my podcast. That's really nice of you.
Thank you, Josh, for having me.
Curious question about you. Did you fall into sales, or did you wake up when you were like 5 years old and say, "Mom, Dad, I am dying to be in sales. Can you get me like a sales little company to play with when I'm young? Because I want to be a salesperson when I grow up." Like, what's your deal?
I definitely fell into it. It was a very kind of roundabout route that I took to end up here. I actually went to university for performing arts. So I was in theater and film, and that's actually why I ended up in Vancouver as well. They call it Hollywood North. So was there for kind of the live performance and the film and TV that's going on there. And my day job was serving for a long time, like working in bars and restaurants. And it was just exhausting. I was really burning the candle at both ends when it came to trying to be on set at, you know, 6:45 in the morning and then have an 8-hour day on set and then rush to the bar until 3 a.m. And so I was like, okay, this is not sustainable. This is not very good. What else can I do? And actually one of my really close friends from university, who's also a musician and kind of has other artistic passions, was the outbound SDR at Predictable Revenue, who was moving into the AE role. So he knew that his role was opening up. He knew that he thought at least that I would have the skills to be able to take that on. And then he suggested I interview and we went from there. And I like to attribute my acting skills as the reason that I was able to basically BS my way into the outbound role.
But that's interesting. What did that person say to you that intrigued you? Because normally you think a sales role and you're like, that's the last thing I would ever want to do because it's got this very negative stereotype.
Yeah, totally. I think part of it had to be that the company itself wasn't very traditional. It was a startup. So that was like, okay, that's good. That's a good start. So the company would be kind of innovative and doing some interesting things. There would be a little more flexibility to the sales role than there might be in other companies. The other part of it was just knowing kind of who my friend was as a person and not thinking of him as this really salesy person. And then hearing how he kind of enjoyed and what he learned from the role.
Did you have some of those negative stereotypes going into it?
I definitely had the kind of thoughts around salespeople that everybody has. It's like, you're gonna go for that sale, even if you're taking the last dime out of like Tiny Tim's Christmas present fund or whatever. So I definitely had those negative connotations, but I think I knew that that was like an old school type of sale and that what Predictable Revenue would be doing or what kind of SaaS companies and other startup style companies or modern companies were doing was not exactly that. So
not exactly that in what way?
Well, I guess when I picture salesperson, it was always like a door-to-door salesperson, actually pounding the pavement or like buying dinner for the prospect, really that face-to-face stuff. And so I knew right away that it was going to be remote. So that removed maybe sort of some of the like schmoozy aspect. And then I had to just ask, like, what does this actually look like? I didn't even know what Zoom was before I started working for Predictable Revenue. So, once I kind of knew that it wasn't that door-to-door face-to-face, I just kind of asked, how do you even do it then? And then I saw that it was actually much more creative because with Outbound, it's completely different depending on who you're reaching out to, in what market, what title they are, what you're selling. So there is no real like, okay, this is what sales looks like. This is what outbound SDR sales looks like.
Once you got into it, what was different about it than the preconceived notions?
Yeah, definitely the sort of like softer approach. I think in my mind, sales was always this like really hard hitting, like go for the close on the first call. But certainly a lot of experimentation had been done right as I was coming into Predictable Revenue around like going for the soft ask instead of booking the meeting on the first email and all of that stuff. So what I was learning was actually how to like craft a message that wasn't, hey, can I have your time because I want to do something? It was like, hey, you guys have this problem. We think we can solve it. We're not just here to waste your time. We really want to help you. We think we can. Would you like to chat? And so that mentality, I think, was the biggest difference from what I thought sales was.
So something you mentioned that's really interesting. So many people talk about their products first. Our product does this and our product does that. You had mentioned that you were starting with a problem that you thought your prospect might have. That sounds like a pretty big shift from the traditional way that people think about selling, which is, let me tell you why my product is the best thing for you. Mm-hmm. And let me, as you put it, you know, take the last 10 cents out of your wallet if you don't have it. So yeah. is that like a shift that you experienced pretty early on in your career that was a little bit different than maybe the preconceived notions you had going in?
Yeah, certainly. I think that was, it was almost right off the bat that I experienced that. And I could see why very quickly, because I could see whether it be thought leaders on LinkedIn sharing the types of emails that they were receiving and how they wish they were actually more kind of problem-centric or value-oriented. And I could see even the prospecting emails that like my colleagues were receiving and how if I was putting myself in a buyer's shoes reading those emails, it was like, oh, of course that's not going to work. Like, why would I answer this email? So yeah, definitely experienced that pretty quickly.
It's interesting. You actually shifted from your point of view into the buyer's point of view. So you were looking more of a buyer's process than the sales process. And if you were looking at these emails thinking to yourself, oh my God, that would be kind of off-putting to me. It's not something that you felt comfortable doing.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Something else I'm really curious about. When I was starting out in sales way back in the early days, you know, one of the mind shifts for me was when I started to think that when I was afraid to reach out to people, it almost was because I felt it was like I had a low sense of self-worth. I was attaching the outcome, which was external, like booking the meeting, to my worth. And when I didn't get it, it felt bad and it would put me in a downward spiral. I later learned that there's like a neuroscience phrase that describes this, which is, you know, neurons that, you know, fire together, wire together. So it was kind of perpetual. Mm-hmm. How much of this plays into your mindset, this idea of I gotta get the meeting at all costs versus I'm not sure, I'm gonna kind of not assume, I'm gonna kind of detach and see if this person even has a problem that I can help with? Like, how much of that stuff plays into your mental game?
Yeah, good question. I had a similar experience to you with that kind of spiral. And it was specifically around cold calling. Because I think I already came in feeling a little bit underqualified as I didn't have a business background. And so I was like afraid that people were going to ask me some kind of technical question or use some acronym that I wasn't going to understand. So I probably went in a little bit nervous right off the bat. And then, yeah, I was like, the only positive outcome from this call is this person saying, yes, I'll have the next call with you or the AE. So I wasn't learning anything from any of the other calls. And actually what you discover very quickly in Outbound is that you are going to have one of those calls where it actually goes the way you want in like maybe 2 days, depending on how many calls you're making. So you better not, attach all your self-worth to that, because it's going to be sad.
So how did you do that? Because this is a big thing that I see a lot of people struggling with, where they attach their self-worth, they attach their worth to the outcome. If I don't book the meeting, I'm not doing a good job. Mm-hmm. And it's this debilitating feeling of rejection. And we obviously don't want to do things that don't feel good. Yeah. It sounds like you have a way to sort of come to terms with that in a sense and get comfortable with it. And I want to see, like, kind of get inside your head a little bit and see how you approach that.
Yep, absolutely. So I think it's sort of two opposing ideas. So the first idea is that you do have to do the things that hurt. You have, as an SDR, you're going to have to make some amount of calls, and that might suck. So the way to push through that is to basically think to yourself that you are gathering information on these calls rather than trying to book the meeting on these calls. So, and that goes back to this kind of problem-centric versus product-centric. You're not getting on that person's call and with the like 10 seconds that they might have for you telling them what you do, you maybe ask them some question about what their pain potentially is, and you see if that triggers some kind of positive response. So for instance, I was calling into industrial companies. What predictable revenue does is help with outbound sales. A lot of industrial companies don't do outbound. They have like field salespeople and then they have inbound, or like just have a big network because they've been around for 50 odd years. And so when I was calling these guys, they didn't even know what outbound was. So I for sure could not just talk about our product. But I could say something along the lines of like, hey, I talked to this company that was a case study of ours, AMG Engineering. They were focusing solely on inbound, but they found that got a little bit unpredictable. Are you guys focusing solely on inbound? And that's like, okay, that's just a conversation starter. So to position the calls more like that, and then just try to get more of a conversation out of these people on each call, but not leading to that meeting, not the thing kind of burning at the back of my mind, like book this meeting, just see if you can get them to talk to you a little bit longer. So figuring out what questions they're most likely to answer, digging in to find that pain, because if you can find that pain, then you can get the meeting. If they do then admit that they've got the pain, then flip to like, okay, why don't we talk about this?
And in that situation, I think that's really smart that you didn't mention outbound, because that's what the thing is and that's what it does. And people don't care about that. They care what it allows them to do better. In that situation, what was the problem with these industrial companies that you were calling into? What was the problem, or what is it that they wanted that they weren't getting?
Yeah, they wanted predictable growth. A lot of them had kind of hit a stasis with their inbound or their network or their trade shows or however they were bringing on new clients. And they were kind of at the whims of the seasons or the market or all these different things that impact the inbound funnel. And they didn't even know that there was another option. They were kind of like, that's how sales is. We call on our book of clients and we see if we sell. And they had no idea that there was an option basically for something else. So that was the problem that they maybe didn't even know that they had or didn't know how to solution.
So this is really, really smart. And I think so many people don't think about this too much, which is they're not sitting around doing nothing. Like, they're generating business somehow. Your prospects are getting the job done that you solve somehow today. But to your point, Sarah, they might not know what's possible. And they might not know what options are out there for helping them be more awesome. And they might not know what problems are lurking around the corner. So it's almost like you're calling them and shining a little flashlight into different little corners saying, have you thought about this? Are you aware of that? And really not even mentioning the product, to your point, because the product doesn't really have any value without the problem. So let's just stay on this one a little bit, because I think it's really important. I love the idea that you talked about, which is they might not know about this. So if you're listening to this and you don't have that insight, like, what might they not know about that can help them get what they want different than what they're doing today? So Sarah's point, they have this feast or famine rut. They're at the whims of these inbound leads that are coming in, and sometimes they have great months and sometimes they don't have great months. And that's a problem for the business. But they might not know about other opportunities to level that off a little bit, so they get a more predictable flow of conversations and ultimately revenue. Just might not be on their radar at all. Another related story to that, I got an email 4 months ago from a car wash company that said, you know, what are you doing to make sure your car wash mitt doesn't scratch your car? And I was like, what? And it turns out that when you dip your car wash mitt in a bucket, dirt can get on it and it could scratch your car. And they sell this bucket with a grate and you wipe the dirt off the sediment, sink to the bottom. I was like, oh, I didn't even know about it. So to your point, this is a sales super skill. And I think people jump into the tactics so quickly that they don't really see this clearly. So in this case, how did that turn into, let's just stick on the cold calling, how did that turn into language? And then we'll talk about your tonality, because I would imagine with your background and your training, you have a lot to say about tonality and inflection, which is often overlooked as well. But let's talk about the words first. How did you then take that insight and then start to craft that into language?
Yeah. So I definitely jotted this kind of stuff down. Like, I started to build a bit of a script, because that opener that I mentioned about kind of like, we talked to this company that's similar to you guys, they were experiencing this pain. How are you guys generating new revenue? That kind of became my opening question. And then from there, I built a bit of like a call flow, a bit of like a if this then that style script. And it would be like, if they say that they only inbound. It's like, okay, great. And what's the follow-up question? So digging further into the pain. So only inbound. Okay. Do you guys feel that you're generating enough revenue to hit your growth goals? What might be a question. Or if they say like, actually our sales teams are going and doing outbound. It's like, okay, honestly, same question. Are you doing enough to hit those goals? So basically, finding the pain and then seeing if, as you mentioned, Josh, kind of their current thing that they're already doing, is it enough for their like loftiest goals?
And it sounds like you're also not assuming, like, correct me if I'm wrong. It sounds like from your tone here and your mindset that if in fact they were not motivated to explore that, you would probably say, okay, and like call somebody else. Like, it doesn't sound like you're too needy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think you can be, because I think this is kind of going to go into the tonality piece. People can tell. And if you're nervous and then needy, they're even less likely to want to have that conversation. So don't, like I said a little bit earlier, treat it as a kind of a discovery call rather than a, I'm trying to book this meeting call. Because you're not going to, like, if you just come in there guns ablaze and trying to book a meeting, nobody wants that. So if you have that little conversation, you get the back and forth going and you discover the pain and then you say, what if there's a solution to that? Then they might be interested in having that
next conversation. It's like you're indifferent to the outcome. Like, if they want to continue and they have this, then great. If not, that's okay too. Because I think, you know, I talk about this a lot. You don't create motivation. You just align with it.
Totally.
And I think so many people can come in. So on this one, you said, hey, we're working with other industrial managers. They tell me that one of the things they're struggling with is getting a more predictable flow of, you know, revenue and opportunities that they're not getting with traditional inbound. Is that something you're struggling with? Are you guys doing okay in that area? Is that kind of the gist of it?
Yeah, that's kind of the gist. Just that last piece, just the question piece, I would actually say, how are you guys generating new revenue? Because not just the like, are you familiar with that? I feel that that can be a little bit vague, specifically for this type of company and persona, because they don't know that there's even anything else. They're like, I don't know. We're still open 50 years on. The people come to us who know us. So like, they probably don't even think that they are struggling with that. But then if you get into how are you generating new business, just network word of mouth, and it's like, oh, okay. Is that kind of holding you back? Then maybe you can ask that next.
Yeah. Next. I love that. One of the things that I do sometimes, I'd love to get your take on this, is I'll give people a multiple choice question to choose from, you know, to make it even a little easier. You know, are you guys doing network events? Is it trade show? Is it word of mouth? Or do you have like an outbound system that's bringing those things in consistently? And I think sometimes that can make it a little bit easier. Is that kind of what you're getting at by not leaving them hanging a little bit? Because then you can kind of get into a conversation cul-de-sac, I guess. And they don't exactly know what to say. So the reason you're phrasing that question after you ask the question, or that beginning statement, is to get a sense of what's the current state? Like, how are you doing this today?
Yeah, exactly. And I think you're looking for more than just a yes or a no, because as you say, that's the cul-de-sac. If you say, does that ring a bell? And they're like, yep. And then they just sit there silently. You're like, I don't know. Okay. So yeah, to kind of get them to have to say more, then you can build on that.
Yeah. I love that. I love that. I think someone, I don't know where I read this, but I think they called it like the illusion of control, where you kind of give these A, B, and C questions just to give people a sense of how to start. So now let's talk a little bit about tonality. This is really something that a lot of people don't really think about. I read some stats somewhere, I'm sure you did too, from your background, that most of the communication is actually how you sound, not even what you're saying. So talk to us a little bit about tonality and what the heck it even is. Are there different tones that you use based on who you're speaking with, based on what you're saying? Do you have like five voices? Can you impersonate Meryl Streep? I have so many questions, but let's just start with the easy ones.
Absolutely. So I think, yeah, tone is hugely important. And the thing that I use as an indicator of where I should go is the other person. So I'm always going to have my sort of standard when I first speak, when they're on the line, but very quickly I'm going to shift to sort of match. There's a term for that too in kind
mirroring.
Of psychology.
And, mirroring.
Yeah, not quite mirroring. It's something else. It's called like tone shift. Anyway, doesn't matter. But it's something that you do to not necessarily mirror them, but to make them feel that you're like part of the same like demographic, or that you're kind of on the same page, that you have the same kind of personality as them. So mirroring is great for sure, because you want to like reiterate things that they're saying and all of that kind of stuff. But the kind of tone part that I think goes beyond mirroring is like the type of slang that they use, or the type of, if they speak in really technical terms, then you use the most technical terms that you can use. If they're really like blunt with you, keep your sentences short. If they're chatty and they like giggle mid sentence, you tell a joke in your next sentence to them. So basically make them feel comfortable and that you're like kindred spirits in a way. By mirroring in terms of language and all that kind of stuff, but also just in the tone of voice and in the kind of the feeling that the conversation has.
So for example, if I picked up a cold call and I said, "Hey, this is Josh," or "Hey, how's it going?" That would be different than "Hello, it's Josh." And you would kind of shift your experience a little bit. Like if you said, "How you doing today?" I'm saying, "I'm doing great. How are you?" That's very different than "What do you want?"
Yeah, exactly.
And you kind of shift your tone a little bit based on those scenarios.
Yeah, you can shift your tone and even add a little bit of color with the kind of wording. So if you had done that big like, "Hey, how are you?" I'd be like, "Good, good. How are you?" And then get into it. If you had done the like, "I'm fine," I'd be like, "You know what, Josh? I know you're busy. I know this is taking time out of your day." Then get into it. So that person has told you something about themselves, basically, in the way that they've answered the phone. It's not always cut and dry like this, but it's those little indicators that you can pick up on that I think make the conversation go more smoothly.
How much of your acting training helped you with this? And I would imagine improv is good for this. I'm sure you've kind of dabbled in that with your background,
yeah.
But you seem to be really good at like reading not just what people are saying, but how they sound. And we're at a disadvantage on the phone because you can't see them. But it sounds like you kind of are visualizing a little bit like, "Oh, I'm talking to someone like this."
Mm-hmm. Yep, I think that's definitely true. You definitely need to be able to think on your feet with this kind of thing. And that's true of a cold call, or even when you actually have a scheduled like Zoom call with a prospect, especially if you can then see them. But even with the video off, you've got to apply this to the conversations that you're having with them. If you have somebody that like drops an F-bomb, drop one back because they're going to love that. And if you have somebody that's like really, really analytical, doesn't want to give up any information about themselves, don't pry. Don't try to dig something out of them that they clearly don't want to give you.
Yeah. So something else I want to get your take on. I was talking to Bailey, who is a SDR over at Outreach. We had a conversation a few days ago. And one of the things she talked about is the importance of believing that what you have can actually help people. So she works over at Outreach and they're fortunate in that they actually use the product and they see the value that it creates. But sometimes you're selling something that you've never used before. You're selling, as you mentioned, to someone that's doing analytics or IT people. And as a new salesperson or as a person that's been in the game for a while, even you can't really see it very crispy because you're not using it. How much does that play into the jitters? Like not exactly, like you're barking the words, but you don't really kind of know exactly what it means exactly. You're saying words like optimizer end to end and mm-hmm. you know you should be saying it, but you don't exactly know.
Yeah, that's huge. I mean, I think the jitters from that comes from this fear that they're going to ask you some question that you can't answer and it's going to totally blow your credibility on this call. So I think the only way to combat that is, of course, if you can't be the end user of your product or service, is just to like know every case study like the back of your hand. So you know how you solved a certain problem for all these different types of companies in these different use cases, to know what's going on the execution side or the implementation side of your company. So if you're not in a company where there are company-wide meetings where you get to hear all the problems and all the good things happening on those teams, make an effort to go speak to these people. It's super important because how could I have known, coming from not knowing what outbound sales was, how we would create establish and optimize a robust outbound engine for a company. Like none of those words meant anything to me.
That's not how you normally talked before you joined the company. That didn't come up in like a casual conversation with a friend, coffee.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So exactly. How did you do that? So you came in and not knowing anything about the space. What did you do to understand your buyer's world more, like the jobs they were getting done and what they were struggling with? Because I would imagine not having done the job, like if you were selling to people that were trying to break into acting, you kind of get the struggles of an actress that's trying to break into acting and working nights. Like you get that because you're living it. But if you're coming in as an SDR and you're not living that job, what did you do to better understand it?
Yeah, there were a couple of different things. One of them was learning from a colleague of mine that was at the company at the time, Kenny McKenzie, who was a big product expert, knew a lot about market fit and jobs to be done theory and that kind of stuff. So jobs to be done theory is huge, because if you actually break it down, people aren't that different in all these businesses and all these different roles. They've got these goals that are pretty similar. And if you in the outbound role are there to find a pain, that pain, although it might be caused by something very technical or solved by something very technical, the pain itself is similar across all these different industries and all these different personas. So it's simpler than you think it is. Like a CEO wants more revenue at the bottom line. It's not more complicated than that. So kind of following the jobs to be done theory of who you're targeting is huge, because then you know their pains, their goals, the tasks they do each day.
Now if the CEO wants more revenue with staying kind of in the jobs to be done theory, and we're not going to go into what that is. If you want to know what that is, please do Google it, because it is a fascinating read to get mm-hmm. you in the mindset of a buyer, not a seller. But in staying with the jobs to be done theory, the CEO wants revenue, but is getting the job done today somehow, and usually won't change unless he or she is not making progress. So how do you understand the current state of the CEO in terms of what they might not know that can hurt them, or what's possible of kind of staying again with the jobs to be done? Because I'm heads down as a CEO. I'm doing whatever I can do. I'm making the French fries in the kitchen with a knife. It's just how I've always made them. Takes an hour and a half. The potatoes are soggy. Takes me an hour and a half to clean up the kitchen, but it's just not how I get the potatoes. It's not like I'm not making French fries. It's not like the CEO is not making revenue. So what did you do? What was your process to understand, like, what do I know that this person doesn't know that can help them get more of what they want?
Absolutely. Well, I'd say that, specifically from my position, because luckily I'm doing outbound, but I'm selling outbound. So in some ways I kind of got to learn two things at once. But it was around the predictability being one side, because if somebody doesn't have an outbound funnel, then again, like the industrial companies, are at the whim of everything else other than themselves and their team. And the other side was I can't remember what I was going to say. It was something that you said about the fries that made me think of it too.
It's like they're in the before state. Is it that they're not doing outbound at all, or they're kind of doing outbound to be able to get a consistent flow of conversations and meetings, but they might not know a better way to do outbound because the way they're doing it is taking 3 hours because they're trying to make French fries with a knife and they don't know about the potato peel or 3000.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was it. It was around if the companies are doing some outbound. So first you've got to determine what they're doing before you can kind of split this up. But if they're doing some outbound and it's not working well, it's this idea of like personalization at scale. That's like the dream for everybody in outbound. How can you personalize? Because you know you need to be relevant and personalized, but then how can you scale it? It takes me 100 years. My people are using G Sheets and writing 1,000 emails a day and it's not working. So for me to kind of tackle that, like this is the goal, this is the dream, and they probably don't have the pieces that allow them to achieve that. So that's where I come in and address that. So with the jobs to be done theory, they have their like top level goals. So like CEO revenue, and then you break it down further and further to kind of the specific goals they have to achieve that top goal. Then what are the daily tasks that they would have to do to achieve these goals, to achieve that goal, so on and so forth. So you're not going to go for the messaging that's straight just for the top level goal, because it's too broad. But if you can go for those bottom tasks and what is stopping them from hitting that, then that's super specific. Because if it's like the time that it's spent doing this, or time managing team, or time hiring new salespeople and employee turnover, if these things are pain points they're experiencing, your messaging can be specific to those.
Yeah, this is really timely because I just did a video about this a couple of days ago. So it's not, you know, so personalization at scale, again, that's a means to an end. Like people are doing that so ultimately they can get a higher percentage of people to start conversations with on a predictable basis, and personalization at scale is a way to go about doing that. But even if people are getting that job done, again, this is pretty much any job that anyone's getting done can always be done better if you can actually bring an idea that can help them do it better. But you have to know what's wrong first, what sucks. And one of the things that I saw that sucked about it was exactly what you were talking about, Sarah, which is people are spending 20 or 25 minutes writing an email. And although these emails are awesome, they can only write 3 or 4 a day. And so it doesn't make economic sense to have salespeople writing, you know, emails that take 30 minutes a day. So can we get most of the pop from personalization, but being able to do it in a more efficient way might be something that people don't know how to do, or they just figure, hey, it just takes 25 minutes to write these kind of emails. And so again, I know where everyone's like, what does she say? What's the tactic? This is the most important part of the whole thing, which is to have this hypothesis, because when you don't, you come in there and people say, well, I'm already doing outbound. Mm-hmm. I'm already doing personalization scale. I'm already doing all this stuff. I'm like, yeah, but what is it that they don't know? Like, what's the dirt in the car wash mitt that they don't know? And I think that, to your point, that perspective is really, is super important.
Yeah, totally agree.
So yeah, let's actually talk a little bit about like what happens when prospects push back a little bit to you. I mean, I know most of the time when people have a cold call with you, they just say yes. They're just in a trance from your amazing opener. And they're like, I'll do it. Here's my credit card. How do I sign up? I know that happens most of the time, but I'm sure like maybe 1 or 2% of the time you get these things. I think they're called objections. I don't know. I've heard about these things. I don't, you know, if you've ever experienced them before. You know, I don't, the typical ones, you know, send me some information. I'm not interested. This is not the right time. Let's go talk about mindset first. When you start to hear people pushing back or putting you on the spot, if you had to really get a little meta about this and think about, what do you think first when you hear this objection? Talk to us a little bit about your mindset, because these things throw people off all the time. People get off balance. They feel nervous. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think the mindset for this is really similar to acting, where if I'm to liken it to a situation like an audition, you've got an audition, you're in front of a panel of people, that's like nerve-wracking enough. And you were supposed to know a page of dialogue and you didn't memorize it, or you didn't memorize it like quite enough, then you're absolutely pooping your pants at this audition, because you don't have the like foundation to be confident and then just go. So the way that I prepared myself for that type of thing in sales was by knowing what the common objections would be and then having the answers ready. Because there's no way, if I'm in a really stressful conversation, that I'm going to be able to think on my feet, certainly not at the beginning when I'm new to the role. I'm not going to be able to think on my feet how to answer this objection, and I'm going to fumble, and then I'm going to lose the conversation. And then it's like this vicious cycle of getting more and more nervous and fumbling more. So knowing what these common objections were. So part of that came from the training that I received and what my peers and managers said they would be. And then part of it was each time I got a new one, writing it down myself. And eventually they all are similar enough. They're all some variation on the same type of groups of objections. And then you are equipped to answer those objections. But without that preparation, there isn't actually some like magical skill where you'd be able to just dodge them. It's too hard.
You're hitting on something so important, and I want to get your take on this. It's like, you have to know your lines, know your lines. In order to get better at anything like acting, you have to know your lines. You're practicing a lot to get good at any kind of thing, like a sport or piano or instrument or anything. Why don't people practice this? Like, what is it about this that I used to do these things in workshops before COVID, then 300 people in a room. I'd hold up these math multiplication cards. I go, you guys call it the answer. 5 times 5, 25, 6 times 5, 30. Send me some information. And then like deer in the headlights. There's only, to your point, 5 or 6 of these. And yet for some reason, we don't practice them. And therefore, to your point, we get a little nervous. What's the cause of that? Do you have any perspective?
I don't know. I think because the stakes are higher, because you're actually speaking to a potential prospect. And so you think like, if I'm practicing and then I don't do well, I've burnt that bridge. So then you don't bother practicing because you don't want to touch these contacts that you have. You don't want to waste them. But then by the time you actually do get on the call with them, you probably waste them anyway, because you'll get the objection and you don't know how to handle it. So it's like a funny, yeah.
Yeah. And how much of this too is like, you have a very, you have confidence about you when you speak, certainly on this podcast. We spoke a little bit about tonality with the cold call, but how important is confidence in diffusing objections? I mean, not just what you're saying, but like how you're delivering the message can make people feel like, wow, this person is really buttoned up. They're sharp as a tack. Even though what you're saying might be a little wonky, but how you're saying it comes across so sharp that it makes people listen a little bit and kind of get engaged. Talk to us a little bit about confidence and tonality with respect to objections.
Yeah. So the tone of voice, I would say one of the things that I learned very quickly was you can take your time with the words that you're saying while you're answering an objection. So don't try to get the words out as quickly as you can, because you might fumble. You'll sound more confident and more knowledgeable if you don't remember the word and then you think of the word and you say it, rather than doing the like, whatever. So take the time instead of the ums. And then the next thing to get kind of scientific about, if you were to look at kind of drawing the tone, with high pitch being, you know, at the top of the axis and the bottom being low tone, a kind of downward inflection at the end of the sentence, or kind of even at the kind of couple of stages through the sentence in the clauses of the sentence, it kind of connotes more confidence than an upward inflection. So as I just spoke, I kind of started up here, I talked the sentence down, here, here, here. And then if you want to ask a question after that, because you've like, here, I've just demonstrated how actually that objection is not an issue, but what about this? And flip it back to them. So yeah.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, if you watch TED Talks and you just watch the people present the information, they have a slower pace, they're calm, there's these deliberate pauses, and therefore it makes them more credible, rather than if you're the high talking and you have like this high pitched sales voice where it seems more frenetic. So I love that. Let's see how this plays out. Put you on the spot a little bit just to see how this all comes together. I guess one of the common objections that you hear all the time is, this sounds interesting, you know, can you send me some information? And when you hear that, you know, my take on this is objections, they're either true or they're just nice ways of not wanting to be the bearer of bad news, because it's an awkward position to be in and you don't want to ever make someone feel bad. So sometimes people say things, not because they're malicious or have an intent, but, you know, send me a proposal, send me some information, like anything to just say, I just need to get off the phone with this person. But it's, they don't want to really say that because it's awkward to say that. It's like, you just don't want to say that. So what's your approach when someone says to you, you know, can you send me some information? Let's assume we're talking to someone that's relatively friendly. We're not talking to like a analytical, not that, and listen, analytical people listening, I'm not saying you're not friendly. You are friendly. Please don't write into the show and post things on LinkedIn about, I don't like, I love analytic people. So if you're, let's just say I'm friendly type, and we'll just role play this a little bit. Hey, you know, Sarah, sounds really interesting. You know, can you send me some information so I could read up on this a little bit more?
Yeah, Josh, I absolutely can. But one more question I do have, just because we didn't tackle this yet, you mentioned that you've got X many salespeople on your team. Are they booking enough meetings for the four AEs that you mentioned you had?
Never enough meetings, Sarah, as you know. We can never have enough here at Sales DNA. We always could use a little bit more.
You're absolutely right. And that is the position that a lot of our clients come to us in. I don't want to waste any more of your time. I can actually bring an expert onto the next call if you want to dig into this any deeper. But I would say that, as I mentioned, these are the different ways that we could help you address that specific challenge. And I'd be happy to chat with you further about that.
Okay. So you kind of, your approach is to sort of get to the root of the problem, which is there a problem worth solving? Because if there is, sending the information might not actually solve what it is that you have a problem with. And so you kind of are asking the question. I think it's smart. It reminds me of something that happened with my mom 7 months ago. She called me. She goes, Josh, I need a new computer. I have to have a new computer. And so if you're a typical person, you might say, gee, mom, which one do you need? I'll go out and get it for you. That would be the equivalent of sending some information. But instead I said, you know, what is it that's leading you to believe you need a new computer? And she said, well, I can't log into Facebook. It turns out she just doesn't know how to reset her password. So I'm the genius bar and I'm trying to walk her through this, which is maddening. If you've ever had to do tech support, it's, I don't know how people do it, but to your point, like, does this person even have a problem to warrant even continuing the conversation? It seems like you're just trying to get to the truth.
Exactly.
Sort of get out of this sort of buyer seller dance.
Yeah. Because if you'd said like, no, I have a great outbound team, we're booking more than enough meetings, I wouldn't be like, okay, I still want to have that meeting. Then it's like, you know what, Josh, good for you. Can you tell me like, what's the magic? How do you do it?
All right. I would be remiss if we don't touch a little bit on emails. We talked a little bit about cold calling and emails. You came on my radar because you were doing some very interesting things and having some phenomenal success with writing emails that were evoking very high response rates. Talk a little bit about what that is, and then I have a couple of questions to follow up with.
Yeah, absolutely. So this sort of strategy was modeled after a Beck Holland strategy, her personalization at scale strategy. So it takes the idea kind of separating what you should use to personalize your emails into buckets. The top ranking bucket will always be self-authored content. The second bucket will be engaged content. So liked, commented, shared. And her strategy is really great for account-based. When you've got a set number of contacts that you're supposed to be reaching out to, you do the research on them, you find their self-authored content, you write the emails. But what I was finding with my lists of people I was reaching out to is that often when I'd go to do that research on LinkedIn, they didn't have a lot of self-offered content, and the engaged content was like liking something totally separate, like maybe their friend on LinkedIn in a different industry, they liked their post. So it wasn't working for me. And
you couldn't, because, and I get this all, I get an email about this a week. I get 5 messages on LinkedIn about this a day, which is essentially this question of what happens if I can't find anything on the LinkedIn profile. I've kind of gone through it, I've perused it, or I can find something, but it's like they're liking like a cookie recipe that doesn't really have anything to do with how I can help. And it seems contrived. If I try to use that, it's awkward. So that was the problem you were bumping into as well, but you seem to have solved that a little bit.
Yeah. So I sort of reverse engineered it. Rather than trying to fabricate the personalization stuff from nothing, I instead took the opposite approach. So I luckily am in sales and selling sales. So I follow a lot of sales thought leaders who have a lot of high engagement on LinkedIn. And so I started to notice that your posts, for instance, would have super high engagement, tons of comments. They would be specifically talking about something that predictable revenue helps people solve. And a ton of those people commenting and liking were within my ICP. So I decided instead to build my lists based on who was already engaging with that relevant content. Because that allowed me to basically templatize these sequences that would be, you know, LinkedIn sequence Josh Braun 1. And I would have...
I have a sequence named after me? Is that true? That's awesome. I'm calling my mom afterwards. I'm letting her... This is amazing. This was almost as good as when I was in the newspaper when I was 13. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, all good. So I have that LinkedIn sequence. It's going to start off with, hey, custom variable person name. I saw you either liked or commented, and this I'll customize as I go, but I saw you liked or commented on Josh Braun's post about, and then what the post was actually about. And it's something that's relevant to what we can do, and it's something that's relevant to those specific prospects. And then what I do, and this is following Beck Holland's template exactly. You can watch her personalization at scale webinar from when she was at G2 Crowd. You can see exactly how to write these emails. So saw you liked, commented on this post about X. What really stood out to me was, and this is where I would either pull an excerpt from Josh's post or the thought leader's post, if that prospect had only liked. So I had nothing to pull from them. But if they'd commented something relevant, like, hey, Josh, yeah, somebody sent me an email yesterday that really sucked because it did exactly this, I would be like, what really stood out to me is that you had actually experienced what Josh was talking about. And then the final part of the email is the what if question. What if question totally changed my life in terms of prospecting. It's this really good soft ask that actually addresses what you're going to help them solve, but without being too pushy. So it's what if, and then like, we could help you solve X problem, but in the words of course, what you guys do. So for us, it might be, what if we could provide you with personalized multi-channel prospecting at scale? And then you say like, give me a chance to unpack that. Let's talk, whatever, book the meeting.
So in LinkedIn Sales Navigator, are you searching certain types of people that are engaging and commenting, or are you like following certain people that you know have high engagement and then reverse engineering it that way? Or is it a little bit of a combination? Are you using like hashtags? Are you using reverse engineering? Like, how are you actually finding that?
Yeah, I'm doing it the second way. So following as many thought leaders as possible who have high enough engagement on their posts to make this type of sequence make sense.
How do you find those people? Like if you're, let's say you're following, like sales, you know, I can kind of get that because I'm in it. But let's say you're in IT. I'm sure every industry has people like, you mentioned thought leaders in their industry doing stuff. Mm-hmm. If you were, let's say you had to work for another company in IT, for instance, how would you go about finding who those people are?
Absolutely. So to look from scratch, hashtags would be a great start. So any of the hashtags that those people might follow, you'll see some posts. Then you can see who's posted those. If it's really high engagement, probably they're one of these thought leaders. Once you start following a thought leader, you'll see other thought leaders engage with their stuff. So somebody who is frequently posting or commenting rather on this thought leader stuff, click on their profile, they might be a thought leader too. So it's sort of, you've got to build it and keep an eye out for all these new people to add. Another thing to specify is that sometimes it won't be on LinkedIn. I made a point of kind of trying to test this out for different industries before doing a kind of lunch and learn with predictable revenue so that we could share the strategy with our clients. And I thought about like the healthcare space or biotech space. There aren't a lot of thought leaders in that space on LinkedIn, but they are on Twitter. So it takes a little bit of extra work to go from somebody's Twitter handle to then find them on LinkedIn or find their email. But it's relatively the same thing. It's just one extra step. So you've got to first know where your audience kind of lives, where they consume their information. Maybe it's Reddit. Like maybe you can even do something there. And then from there, follow those thought leaders with the high engagement and then cherry pick these relevant posts.
I love it. And what happens if you are doing account-based? I guess you have to kind of default to the other strategy, obviously, if you're not able to do it this way, right? I mean,
the sales nav that you mentioned filtering, that's when that's great. Because if you have a list or you're building a list, you can filter it by those that have been active on LinkedIn in the past 30 days. And then you're more likely to be able to do it the original Beck Holland way.
I get it. And when you look through these lists of comments, you're filtering that out. Obviously there's some people, like if you see an SDR, for instance, would you actually take that SDR and say to a VP of sales, notice that your SDR commented on this thing? Would you kind of go there or not really go there?
I haven't really for this strategy. That is something that I've tried other times.
Too far removed, maybe?
I think sometimes too far removed. And I also wonder if it comes across a little bit as trying to undermine what they're doing as a VP sales. Like, oh, your SDRs are like looking for training. Obviously you're not doing a good enough job of training. So I think it's better to go straight for that VP sales who says like, yeah, this is totally true. And then you're like, just go straight for that person.
I completely understand. Sarah Hicks, you have said it all. And then some. You have dropped so much wisdom and knowledge on our crowd, which I'm sure is eagerly taking notes. If they're not, they should rewind and take notes, because knowing and doing are different things. Knowing and learning scratches an itch. It feels good. But doing is the thing that's going to change your results and outcomes. I do over IQ. So make sure that you're actually not just consuming this information, but you're actually taking something. It doesn't have to be everything. Something that Sarah shared, and go out and do it. And if you get stuck, and Sarah's in a good mood, she might help you. Is that true, Sarah? Or are you not open to helping anybody that's listening to this do anything? I mean, it's up to you to answer that question.
No, I'm totally open to it. I'd love if you connect with me on LinkedIn. And if you have any questions about any of this stuff, happy to answer. Also would love to hear if you do try something that I mentioned, tell me how it worked. I've had some people say like, I gave that LinkedIn thing a go and I booked, 10 meetings. So that's always really, really nice to hear. And I would love to hear that from you.
Sarah, thank you so much. You've been so generous with your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Josh.